For over 150 years, Nelson's Pillar dominated O'Connell Street in Dublin. The granite structure was erected in the early 19th century to commemorate the British naval commander Horatio Nelson. He was killed, of course, in 1805 at the Battle of Trafalgar, Britain's most decisive naval victory of the Napoleonic Wars. The monument received a mixed reception from the very start and was a subject of debate from the day it was unveiled in 1809 until its destruction by a bomb on the 8th of March 1966. Michael Lawless took to the streets this week to hear how people remember the destruction of Nelson's Pillar.
I remember it being blown up. I can vaguely remember being woken up one morning on the radio and the pictures in the paper that evening of half the column still remaining.
I was around when it was blown up, yeah. They should have left it there.
I was in town the night it was blown up. I was at a dance up in the Galway Arms. We were all only teenagers. And we always walked
home. Yeah, I'm
home.
Very sad that it's gone. What they put up instead of it is a total disgrace.
I remember it was boom. You hear the same with the bombings in. I was coming out of work too, 17th of December, half five. I remember that one as well. And everyone was running to O'Connell Street for a bit of the rock and a bit of the dust and everything.
I do remember it being blown up. It was there one day and it was gone the next.
Michael Lawless talking to people there about how they remember the destruction of Nelson's Pillar. And I'm joined by Donal Fallon, author of a new book, The Pillar, The Life and Afterlife of Nelson's Pillar. Also here with me is photographer Paul O'Dear, whose photographs of the bombing's aftermath appear in the book. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Now, I said that it dominated O'Connell Street for 150 years. It didn't, because it dominated Sackville Street for many of those years, from 1809 until the 1920s. What kind of a street was Sackville Street and then O'Connell Street?
Indeed, well, long before McDonald's, Eddie Rockets and Burger King took over, it was very much a residential street when laid out in the 18th century. And the end product of Luke Gardner, the banker and developer, his great vision for the city. Henrietta Street is another Gardner Street, but Sackville Street was envisioned as a residential street which would attract the wealthy elite of Dublin. So Nelson's Pillar, or the Nelson Pillar, the proper title, but Dubliners always knew it as Nelson's Pillar or the Pillar. When the Nelson Pillar goes up, it's a very different environment that it's placed in. It's not surrounded by commercial units as it is today. It's very much in the middle of a residential street.
A very broad residential street. Was that unusual for Dublin at the
time? Indeed.
And
I think you get, even today, you get a sense of the importance of that street when you look at the sheer width of it and the White Streets Commission and their vision. I think O'Connell Street, even now, it feels like an important street, even if that's not necessarily reflected in the units that are there now.
When did the idea of constructing a monument to Nelson in Dublin first emerge, and where did the initiative come from? Did it come from Dublin? Did it come from London?
Dublin is remarkably early in commemorating Nelson. In fact, the pillar goes up over 30 years before Nelson's column. In London. It's by no means the first monument that's erected to Nelson, but still, even in a global context, it's very, very early. It's only a few short years after Nelson's death at Trafalgar in 1807 that there's talk about commemorating Nelson in the city. And it's the aldermen of Dublin and also leading business figures from across the religious divide, both Catholic and Protestant, that are pushing for a monument to Nelson. Some interesting Dublin families pop up here. The Latouche family, the Huguenots, who've been very involved in banking, they're involved. A little known family called the Guinnesses. Arthur Guinness is involved. It's not Arthur's Day Guinness, but the son, Arthur Jr. He's there and he's on the committee that puts up the pillar. So it's a very broad cross-section of Irish life and across the religious divide.
Nowadays, when you want to build anything, there's a competition. Was there a competition for the design of this memorial?
There is. And the winner, unfortunately for him, it's not quite his design that goes up. William Wilkins wins the competition, but the Nelson Pillar that goes up is the work of Francis Johnson, one of the great architects of Dublin's history. He gave us a general post office. The chapel in Dublin Castle is another example of his work. Ultimately, despite the fact Wilkins won the competition, the committee had to say that they couldn't afford to bring his vision to fruition. So it's Francis Johnson who gives us the pillar.
And tell us about the reaction then to the pillar when it was completed in 1809.
There's a wide variety of reactions, primarily negative, it should be said, though often not for political reasons. From what I can see, the most vocal political opposition comes from a magazine, the Irish Monthly, Watty Cox, who'd been around the United Irish movement.
A real contrarian, if ever there
totally,
was
totally. If there was ever one, he had nothing good to say, and from a political point of view. But he's really the only one that makes the obvious connection that Ireland had an attempted revolution in the 1790s, backed by the French, and here was a man who had defeated, who had played a role in defeating the French, suddenly in the centre of Dublin. More people raise opposition to how it looks. There's quite a lot of opposition on aesthetic grounds. And that was a theme right through the life of the pillar. Right into the 50s, people were calling it a traffic obstacle or whatever else. But in the early 19th century, people thought it was disproportionate and that it took away from everything around it.
Now, a tale that has become something of a legend of Easter Week in 1916 is that the rebels attempted to blow up the monument, the Nelson's Pillar. Is that actually true? Did that happen?
The fault for this one rests with the famous Sinn Féin Rebellion Handbook, a great-selling publication. The Irish Times are behind it. It came out not long after the rebellion, and it tells a story of an attempt by volunteers to blow up the Nelson Pillar. Some of the international media, there was one New York newspaper that claimed Nelson's Pillar was gone in the aftermath of the Rising, that it was one of the structures that was lost to the flames of Easter Week. The story that they attempted to blow it up, there's nothing to it. There's nothing to it at all. The volunteers were testing grenades. A grenade had gone off in the general post office, almost killing all around it. And there was a decision made to test grenades against Nelson's Pillar. But there was no belief that it was going to bring down the structure.
As it would have been very easy, I suppose, for it to have disappeared in 1916, given
Indeed.
What happened
well,
to Sackville Street.
Think about
Street
the Helga. Then. She seems to smack everything except Daniel O'Connell and Admiral Nelson. it's remarkable they were still there. It was actually used by rebels in 1916. In some of the Bureau of Military History statements, rebels talk about the gauntlet of O'Connell Street, trying to get from one side to the other, from one occupied position to another, and how the pillar actually... Rather than Republicans blowing it up, they availed of it because they could kind of hide in the doorway of Nelson's Pillar.
And they didn't have anybody up there as observers, using, you know, given the altitude of the
pillar. They didn't. Someone went up in 1917 on the first anniversary of the Rising and put a tricolour up there. But during the week in 1916, they didn't.
You'd think that was probably something of a mischance. Now, after Ireland then gained its independence, was there a renewed discussion about, well, what are we going to do with your man in O'Connell Street?
Some argue he should stay. William Butler Yeats argues that it is not a beautiful object, in his own words, but that it means something to the Protestant people of Ireland. And Yeats makes an argument that it should remain. There's all kinds of bizarre movements to replace Nelson. There's a very strong movement in the 1930s to erect the statue of the Virgin Mary on top of the pillar. There's a movement led by a Fianna Fáil Cumann, I think in Donegal. They wanted a statue of Robert Emmet to go on top of the pillar. And their argument was, maybe it will inspire Protestant men in the north. You see this courageous Protestant gazing down over Dublin, Robert Emmet. In 65, my favourite one, Red Mike Quill, a radical trade unionist in New York City who'd come from County Kerry, he lobbies the government. And what he wants is one of three. He wants one, Pádraig Pearse, if Pearse is too controversial, Jim Larkin. And if they're both too controversial, John F. Kennedy. This is 65. And the Transport Workers Union, they offered to finance the removal of Horatio and his replacement with a statue of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, well, Larkin actually does make it to O'Connell Street eventually.
Indeed. Yeah,
but
Ocean
not that exalted height. So by the 1960s, was the pillar considered to be a symbol, an outdated symbol of British imperialism? What was the attitude by then?
I think Thomas Bodkin, in a radio lecture, he said, to me, it wasn't Nelson's Pillar or the Nelson Pillar. It was just a pillar. I think to a lot of people in Irish life, it was a viewing platform. And that was how it was regarded. I think by the 60s, for the most part, any kind of political controversies around the monument, I think it kind of fallen away.
You're nodding, Paul. Would you agree with that? To you,
yeah,
when you were growing up, it was the pillar.
That was my feeling. It was just the pillar, yeah. It was something that Dubliners, for the greater part, never went up unless you were shown somebody around, which is how I ended up going up the thing. But since it came down, my attitude to it was it should have been left well enough alone, and the most that should have been done was that if a statue was going to be put up or any monument put up, it shouldn't have been higher than the statues between O'Connell and Parnell, like the, whatever was going up there. So it didn't take from the street as it was. But unfortunately, Celtic Tiger hubris interfered.
We'll talk to you in a moment about your memories of the 8th of March 1966. Obviously, you weren't there when the pillar was blown up, but you were there in the aftermath. Tell us what is known, Donal, about that operation, which may or may not have been an IRA operation.
There's a massive mythology around this, and this was the 50th anniversary year of the Easter Rising. Certainly, this action, I think, overshadowed anything the state could do in 66. And when you ask people about the 50th anniversary of the 1916 Rising, their abiding memory is not the Garden of Remembrance or the march down O'Connell Street. What they remember is the pillar being blown up. What they can't quite remember is who did it. And the mythology, the folklore has it that this was the IRA. I suppose in modern language, we would blame this on dissidents. This was the work of a group of former IRA members, a left-wing cell, if you will, that had been inside and by this point was outside of the IRA, kind of largely around Joseph Crystal, a brilliant cyclist. When he died, the obituaries talked plenty about his time as a cyclist and little about his time as a Republican. Crystal was one of the people that was up Nelson's Pillar in 1955. Students attempted to burn down Nelson with flamethrowers. Crystal was up there on that occasion. But the group around Crystal, what's become known as the Crystal Group, were very much involved in the ultimate downfall of Nelson. Liam Sutcliffe is the only Republican that has publicly placed himself there. At the turn of the millennium, in an interview on RT Radio, he talked about the story of blowing up the pillar and how, in fact, they had gone up prior to the 8th of March and left an explosive device that failed to go off, and having to retrieve that bomb and plant another one, which went off at 1:30 in the morning of the 8th of March. Sutcliffe had been in the IRA, though by this point was outside of it. So it's not an IRA-sanctioned action. The IRA often condemned the bombing of monuments in the 40s, the 50s and the 60s. They see it as a kind of sideshow. Now, Unfublocht does find the humour in what's happened to Nelson. They're certainly not condemning the bombing of the Nelson Pillar, but they're making it clear it wasn't them too.
Now, then the rest of the day then, Paul, what are your memories of that? You were presumably there taking photographs. There must have been a lot of curiosity.
I wasn't there that night, but I certainly turned up because I was in the habit of having a camera on me anywhere I went since my early teens. And I turned up, I was in UCD at the time, so I could afford to divert slightly on my way into college. And I turned up there virtually every day between the day that it was blown up and the day that there was just a piece of flat nothingness there. People were curious. I mean, it's the normal rubberneck stuff that was going on, like, and it was a huge event. I don't think people were too worried one way or the other. It was just a great big circus as far as people were concerned. And, like, it wasn't seen necessarily as a political act, except maybe by a few people.
Mm. Architectural demolition.
Yeah, because the landmark, it wasn't gone, but it was staring at you. And it had this little piece, which was the actual round part that Nelson stood on, perched up on the top of it at an angle. And it looked like it could have fallen at any minute. And at the time, I thought that was the top of the pillar. But looking at the photograph since, I realised that about a third of the actual column had gone. And this thing had come down and sat about a third of the way down the pillar on the top of the thing. And, of course, the rest of it had bounced off the base and broken traffic lights and gone into windows and this taxi guy nearly...
But didn't cause quite as much damage as the controlled demolition, so-called, that took place a short time or about a week or so afterwards. This was the army who basically
being provocative.
Did they break every window in O'Connell Street?
This is the great one, the joke, you know, leave it to the professionals.
Yeah.
You would expect the army would have done more damage because their explosives, their charge would have been closer to the ground. So you would expect them to do significantly more damage. But looking at the compensation claims, it doesn't actually appear that they did. So I think everyone saw the joke before their eyes and couldn't resist.
So that's another myth as well.
Humour is really what shines true after the pillar's
red rag to a bull. I found myself, this one is thrown anytime the pillar comes up. I was in the little museum there recently going around. There's a beautiful big picture of the pillar on the wall. And some woman woman in the crowd that was going around said, yeah, and the army did an awful mess of this. Jez, I took the head off her.
Yeah. Humour really shines through. There's the joke about the army doing more damage. There's a Dubliner single, which is hilarious. Nelson's Farewell, and it was that great one, I Can See Cleary's Now the Pillar's Gone. You know, it was humour, it was right there after the after
well
the
I don't know if you want to talk about it, but the army, apart from doing a very efficient job, the army actually provided the people of Dublin with a night's entertainment that they would never forget. It was floodlit. And the crowds were, there was jollity all around the place. There were a few Welsh people left over from a Welsh match that were trying to figure out what was going on.
They laid a wreath at the site as well.
Did they? They were looking totally lost. But there was a commentary on the tannoy from the GPO. Kevin O'Kelly was given a commentary, which was every bit as exciting as his subsequent moon landing. And it was 3-2-1, the thing went off and the place went absolutely berserk.
And you were there taking photographs?
Oh, I was there taking photographs, and I was on a Honda Cub. With Tom Ferris, a friend of mine, and we went around up the Parnell Street end and everywhere. And God bless the army. This was better than the Artane Boys band, I'll have to say that.
And God bless Nelson's head, because that was the gift, Donald, that kept on giving, wasn't it?
Oh, God, it really was. One of my favourite images in the book is students from the National College of Art and Design who liberated Nelson's head from a corporation shed. They photographed themselves with Nelson's head, and they're wearing balaclavas and scarves around their faces. The student union was very heavily in debt in NCAD, and they saw an opportunity to make a few quid here. They went on to live very exciting lives. One became an actor in the Reardons. One became a lecturer in NCAD. But they would gift out Nelson's head to anyone who was willing to pay for it. It ended up, Paul, as a photograph of it at Killiney Beach. It ended up on stage with the Dubliners. It ended up in an antique shop in London. Benny Gray rented it off these students quite a while. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, Benny Gray returned it on the back of a lorry. He drove down O'Connell Street in the back of a lorry with the Dubliners. And they played a kind of edited version of Nelson's Farewell, Nelson's Return. And when he got to the General Post Office, he asked if anyone was from the corporation, and it was handed over. So it was another bemusing spectacle in the whole story.
Paul, tell us about that photograph. It's in the book, and this is the photograph of young men standing around an old mini on the beach at Killiney with Nelson's head.
Yeah, I was out for a walk, and I happened to have my camera with me, which I normally had just had. And I was up at the Holy Child Bridge, and I saw across at Holman's, which is the far end of the beach, there was something funny going on at the shoreline. There was a boat drawn up and there were some sort of odd-looking people at it. So I went charging off. By the time I got there, everybody was in normal gear and whatever. And there was a little Austin Mini down on the beach, and there was a sack halfway up the beach that had left a huge big ridge. It took four fellas to pull it up the beach, and that was fine. So I started taking shots of the guys at the Mini, and one fella ran around and sat in front of the registration number. So I thought, this is something serious going on, and then I forgot about it. I just had the negatives, and that was it. And very shortly afterwards, a fashion photo appeared in the evening press of the boat, the prow of the boat, these guys with their oars on either side as a sort of guard of honour, Nelson's head down at the bottom of the boat, and two ones in fashion clothes in the boat.
Who'd kind been, of mod fashion.
Yeah, fashion stuff, who'd been from Boylan's, who'd been patched in the studio. So the guys had obviously flogged the picture to Boylan's for this. So Nelson has actually been in a serious fashion shoot in Killiney Beach.
He still gets around. Where is he today, though? Where's the head today?
Dublin City Library and Archives on Pearse Street. And he's sitting there in the reading room. You can go and see him with a chip in his lip from 1916.
But no chip on his shoulder. Thank you very much indeed for that. Highly entertaining. And Donald's book, The Pillar, The Life and Afterlife of Nelson's Pillar, featuring many photos by Paul O'Dear, is published by New Ireland Books. Donal and Paul, thank you both very much for joining us this evening. And you can see a lot of those photographs on our website.